My name's Rick. I'm an alcoholic.
Bye, alcoholic.
Okay, we're going to pick this up basically where we left off. I'll kind of bring it up to speed a little bit just to give you some idea of what we've been doing. We started this out talking about honesty, okay? That I have to be honest with myself. Okay, I'm not saying you shouldn't be honest with others. But ultimately, I can be very honest with others and very dishonest with myself. And this is the thing that's really caused me a lot of problems, is all this self-deception I've had. And I really would not have believed it had I not done some inventory and got a dose of reality. I've got a quote that I want to share with you. It's not from AA, but it fits beautifully. It says, sincerity is not enough. What we need is honesty. So what's the difference? Honesty is a never-ending openness to the facts. Sincerity is believing one's own propaganda. So you can be very sincere and full of crap.
So I often have been.
And very sincere about it. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. That's a key idea in this material and something that is easily overlooked. A lot of us, we skip over these sentences and just, you know, I don't want to look that deep, because it's one thing to admit you're an alcoholic. It's another thing to admit you're selfish. What I've learned to do is not look at selfishness as good or bad. It's just a fact. By definition, I read the definition yesterday. By definition, I'm doing for myself and I'm not considering other people. I'm looking for an advantage, some pleasure, some well-being, and in achieving that, I don't consider others. That does not mean I'm bad. It just means I'm selfish. And if you can start to look at this stuff factually instead of judgmentally, because a lot of these words carry a lot of judgment for some of us, especially the way they've been laid on me, you know, or labeled, the way I've been labeled by them. And people were being judgmental toward me when they said these things, and I understand that. But literally, the word is not good or bad. It's just simply a fact. It's what I do, okay? Otherwise, it's very difficult to look at this stuff. I just won't look. And it's a key idea in here. I think we left off on the middle of page 63 in the book, right after the third step prayer. All of these ideas that we were reading last night are literally third step ideas, but a lot of them have fourth step ideas in them. See, that's why I think it's important, because if I can start to understand what they're talking about, all right? I've had a lot of negative things happen to me out of my selfishness that I didn't attribute it to that. I thought it was other people doing it. I'll give you an example of a really bad result I got out of selfishness. And it was unaware of it for most of my life. All of this that we've been reading has been, we're going to reverse the selfishness. Selfishness is the problem. They've identified the problem. We haven't looked at any solution at this point other than we're going to reverse the selfishness, right? That's the way the book is kind of laid out. The third step prayer illustrates that pretty well, that it's all about God help me to be helpful. I mean, that's really what it's asking. I'm just asking God to help me to be helpful to others, because if I'm taking, I'm out of harmony with love. I'm out of harmony with God. And that doesn't matter if I believe in God or not. I'm still out of harmony with love. If you don't believe in God, you know what love is. Love gives. Taking is meaningless to love. Love gives. It's just that simple. No conditions, no expectations, period. Anytime you put anything else on top of it, you lose it. What's sad is our culture, I don't even like to use the term when I'm working with guys, because our culture is so steeped in nonsense about what love is that nobody knows what it is. You use the word, you think it's painful. I mean, it's just music.
We say unconditional love.
We have to.
Like, what's conditional love? I love you if you do the following things that I want you to do.
Right. You know, that's
conditional love, right?
So here's a really bad result I got out of selfishness that I saw later on, okay? Most of my life, and I'd hear it, because I wasn't religious. I had no religious training, okay? I'd never been to church, anything like that as a kid. I was raised in a family of, actually, they were communists. My dad was a Red. And he had a friend named Joe Stern who was a communist, and they were going over to Cuba, Soviet Union, and they were coming back with their slideshows and stuff. This is in the 60s when you didn't do this stuff, okay? And I got to tell you, Joe Stern had a lumber yard, and I sat in that lumber truck from the time I was about 12 years old on and got my communist training, okay? That's just the way it was. So I was really heavily steeped in those ideas, okay? And then I'm growing up in a capitalist country, and everywhere I go, I'm in conflict because I'm puking this stuff out at parties and things. And, oh, you can imagine I was really a it was a problem, man. It was just a problem. It was just a problem, and I'm aggressive with it and that sort of thing. So these ideas were very difficult for me. It really was. Coming to believe was the last thing I ever thought I'd be able to do, all right? But I used to hear people talk about things like they'd say, well, what you sow, you reap, is the way the Christians put it. I didn't know what the heck they were talking about. Then I'd hear it on the streets. On the streets, it was what goes around comes around. In other words, you're going to receive what you give, period. Well, here I'd been a thief all my life. Now, I used to think this is nice sentiment, but it really isn't actually happening in my life, is it? I mean, come on, I've been stealing things. I have a temporary gain. I steal something, I've got a gain, right? It seems like you can gain by taking. Well, here's what I saw. It was shocking to me when this came to me. Now, you might say, I'm not a thief. I don't steal material things. Well, how about in relationships? I mean, think about your relationships. Do I go into a relationship? I want to get to know that woman or guy who's got a lot of money so they can take care of me. I'm trying to get some. I stay in relationships long after the relationship should have ended because I'm afraid of being alone. I don't even like her. But it's better than being alone. I like the sex. I don't like her. I only like parts of her. You know what I mean? It's sad, isn't it? But it's true. Isn't it? I don't know about you guys, but I'm talking from my own experience here. I've done this kind of crap, okay? Well, I've been a thief in relationships. Not only stealing material things, but in my relationships, every time I would interact with people, it was always to get an advantage, to get something from them. Here's what I saw. I took and took and took until I had nothing left. Now, you'd think you'd have something, wouldn't you? When I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1987, the family was gone, the money was gone, the house was gone, the business was gone. I had no friends. Was I receiving what I was giving? Yeah, I was taking from life and I was losing. Oh, but I had theories, you know, that said you gain by taking. You steal a material thing, you've got a temporary gain, right? I'd always lose it. In the small picture, it looks like you're gaining. In the big picture, if I look at my whole life, I can see I was losing. Now, I'm a guy who likes to think his theories are correct. You take, you gain. Remember, the guy with the helicopter had enough sense to adapt his theories to the experience. I'm so dull in this area. I've been particularly stupid in this area that I'm trying to get the world and everything to adapt to my theories. It never occurred to me that I was losing because of what I was doing. Yet, it was said to me in many different forms over my lifetime, but I couldn't hear them. And even the experience was showing me, by the time I walked into AA, it was all gone. And that's just a fact. So that's a really bad result if you don't think selfishness is the problem. The more you take, the more you lose. The more you give, the more you're going to have. You can't have unless you give. And this is what I think we've been reading over the last hour that we spent last night. It literally is saying this. They're saying, okay, we're going to reverse the selfishness and practice giving. I mean, that's literally what they do in here. That's the solution to a life lived out of selfishness. I was reading this part of the book to a guy many years ago, and he looks at me and he says, okay, I see what you mean, but you can't just be giving all the time. I said, really, why not? He says, you know, people can take advantage of you. You know, they'll use you. You're good-naturedness. They'll take advantage of you. I said, how can they take advantage of you? If you give them something, it's not yours, right? You see, you're not hurt by the giving. You're hurt by your expectation that something be returned. Okay? You ever give a Christmas gift to somebody and they don't wear it, or she returns it, or she, oh boy, re-gifts it? You see, oh, that's the worst, you know? And you feel hurt because of it. You know what you're hurt by? Your expectation. You're not hurt by the giving. It's my demands that are hurting me. It's how I think about these things that's causing me my pain. It's astonishing when you start to see this. In fact, I got a quote from a guy. There's a guy named Big Rodney. I have no idea who Big Rodney is. He's at the Salvation Army. I know this much about him. And I know he's a real big, like 400-pound black man. And he sends me a text every day. I have no idea why he sends it to me. I get a text from him every day, without fail. Here's what Big Rodney sent me one day. Accepting responsibility for our own happiness frees us from others' control. Isn't that interesting? Accepting responsibility for my own happiness frees me from others' control. I'm not controlled by anybody unless I give them that power over me. And that's been the problem. You know, we sit around, we tell guys, oh, stay out of relationships. And say, why? Women can hurt me? No, they can't. Women don't hurt me. I hurt myself by how I think about things. I give her a lot of power, and then I suffer out of the power I give her over me. Well, who the heck's doing that? This is what's going on, see? And the more you start to see this through the process of inventory, the more you take your power back. I'm not of this mind who says, well, I'm powerless over people, places, and things. I don't buy that for a minute. Not that I think I can control people, places, and things, but people, places, and things don't have control over me unless I give them that. That's the reality. I'm powerless over alcohol.
When you drink it.
When I drink it. So, this whole thing with selfishness, you know, this is the problem. When I've given things to people, I've stayed with the gift, and I've hurt myself because of that sort of thing. That's why I think it's really important that we have some understanding of the manifestations of selfishness. Self is the problem. My need to take from life is what's causing me to fail at life. I wouldn't have believed that in a million years when I came in here, but I can see it today.
But Rick's right when he says we don't really want to admit to being selfish. I tried an experiment a few years ago. I introduced myself at a meeting. I said, my name is Bob and I'm selfish and self-centered. Instead of saying I'm an alcoholic, I said I'm selfish and self-centered. Some people got mad at me for that. Can I do a different process, same result? When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been a dry drunk for 23 years. I was sober, had an experience, stopped drinking. Drinking was removed. But I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I came in here, I was making a lot of money. I had my own company. I was very successful. I had people working for me. I was driving a Mercedes. I had a beautiful, much younger trophy girlfriend. I had a nice home. Everybody would look at me and say, what a success. Look at Bob, is such a success. And I was so miserable, I couldn't stand it. I hated everything, and I didn't know what was wrong. What's wrong with this picture? Guy's got money, guy's got his own business, guy's got all the stuff that everybody is supposed to want. You know, our culture tells us we got to get all this stuff. What's wrong with this picture? I did not know what was wrong, and I was miserable. I wanted to die. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and started to do this, and total change. I don't have the business anymore. Pam left me. I don't have the home. The car got repossessed. I wouldn't trade for anything. I would not go back to that for anything. So what's that experience? You know, having, taking, getting, making everybody else miserable. I was so miserable I couldn't stand it.
You know, he goes to his first, listen to this, this is absolutely absurd. Bob goes to his first AA meeting and gets a medallion for 23 years sober. He's an instant old timer. It's true.
But I met a man, I'll say his name, Len Japs. He just passed away a few weeks ago, so I can say his whole name. But Len took me on as a sponsee back then. But here's what happened. He told me a story, and he didn't even remember the story. So I think God's in here somewhere. But he's telling about a guy that used to go to an AA meeting once a year to get his medallion. And I said, I thought you were supposed to go to AA every week. And Len says, many of us go more than that. But that's not what the medallion's for. I said, well, what's the medallion for? How long since you had a drink? Well, I said, I haven't had a drink in quite a while. How long? He says, 23 years. I was a dry drunk for 23 years. He says, we got a meeting Thursday night. Why don't you come to this meeting Thursday night? He gave me the address. So I went there, medallion for 23 years. Instant old timer. Yeah. And then he did, I have to tell this part of it, because he did the magic. If I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and somebody said, you're a loser, you don't know anything, shut up, call me six times a day, blah, 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 you're powerless over everything, your best thinking got you here. I hate that one. My best thinking didn't get me here. My worst thinking got me here. My best thinking got me pretty successful. If somebody had said that to me when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have been gone 20 years ago. I wouldn't have put up with that for a minute. But Len didn't do that. He didn't tell me I was a loser. He didn't tell me anything. Here's what he did. He said the magic words. He said, you know, we put on a meeting at the Hennepin County Workhouse on Saturday. Why don't you come along? It was my 12-step experience. And one of the guys, who was it talking last night over in the other cabin, virtually quoting Len, the same kind of experience that I had, this gentleman was talking about. His sponsor said, put the plug in the jug and come on along. Do some work. That was you. Yeah. I had the same experience. Come on along. Come on, join in. And you know what? I'm doing this for like a month or so, and I start to feel better. Life's not so bad anymore. I don't even know what's happened. I've been clueless my whole life, by the way. I've been very blessed to be clueless, and I'm very happy to still be clueless. And that's what happened to me. I started doing this, and it just worked. It just worked. I don't even know what I'm doing. I'm going along, and I'm trying to carry a message to people who need it, and it just works. If you haven't noticed by now, I love this. This is the most profound thing that's ever happened in my life, is this chapter of this book.
So the problem is self, okay? And one of the things that happened to me, and I think it happens to many of us, is you get excited. You start reading this stuff, you get excited about the material, and then you want to share it, and you go around, you ram it down everybody's throat. Beat people up with the big book, you know. This stuff applies to us, not everybody else. Right. If you start applying it to everybody else, it'll do you damage. It will. It'll actually cause damage to you and your relationships. You got to keep it here. Over the years, I've heard many people talk about self-esteem. We're gonna do esteemable acts. That's not what this is for me. This isn't about making a better self. This is about releasing the self. When you let go of what you're not, what emerges is your true nature. You don't have to do something to be spiritual. If you get the crap out of the way, your spirituality will emerge. That's what we're going to do with inventory. Let go of what I'm not. What will emerge is my spiritual nature. This happened to me as an atheist. And a guy come up to me. I'm about, I don't know, maybe 9 months sober at the time. I've written inventory. I've gotten real excited because of all the relief I got. And this guy comes up to me and he says, will you help me spiritually? I looked at him, almost laughed in his face. I couldn't believe he said it to me. I thought, what are you talking about? He saw something in me that I didn't know was there. It's exactly what they wrote in the spiritual experience in the back of the book. He saw the change, and I didn't even know it had changed. And I looked at him, I thought, this is the weirdest journey I've ever been on. Help you spiritually? Are you kidding? I'm still an atheist. Don't you know that? No, he didn't. He didn't. He saw the enthusiasm I had. Now, the problem that can happen out of this is you can have a lot of enthusiasm and no awareness of how it affects others. And you can be a big pain to other people. That's a problem. It's been important that I get some awareness of how I act and sound. And I started watching myself, observing myself, sort of like you're hovering over here, watching yourself and how people react. And I started doing this many years ago, not because I wanted to cater to people's nonsense, because they might be crazy, okay? It's not about catering to people who are nuts. But it is about getting some awareness of how I am. Because if I'm trying to be helpful to others, I don't want to be causing defendedness in others, you know, or bringing up their negativeness toward me if I'm trying to be helpful. It just isn't helpful. So I did that to learn and observe myself and see what worked and what didn't work. Let go of what doesn't work. That's all. This is so important because it wasn't about trying to people please or get people to like me. It was simply because it wasn't helpful to do it. And I learned this by trial and error. It took some time to observe myself. So great enthusiasm without awareness, you can be a real pain to people. And you can give AA a black eye doing that stuff too. You can push people out of the fellowship. Bill Wilson was very, very adamant about how we looked to the outside world and to the newcomers. He was very interested in that. You know, you read the history of AA. And I appreciated that stuff. That's why the old timers, when I got sober, I come from a club where it's all old timers. And these guys were 20, 30 years sober. All of them were 20, 30 years older than I was. And I sat in those meetings and these guys, I'm telling you, I loved them guys. They really walked with me. They didn't put you down. They didn't tell you what to do. They shared what they did. There was none of this aggressive, if you don't do what I tell you, I'm going to fire you crap. You know, that stuff didn't exist in that world with those guys. They weren't like that. A lot of that stuff has kind of evolved in the last maybe 30 years or something around our fellowship. I'm not sure where all that comes from. I don't care. But all I know is that if I'd have run into that when I got sober, I wouldn't have stayed here. I'd have walked. I wasn't going to put up with that stuff. I'm not a lamb. I'm not the kind of guy who's just going to follow somebody because he says, follow me. And if you don't do every dictate that I tell you, you're not working a program. That kind of, I'd have left. I would have walked away. So I think that this thing started with one alcoholic sharing what he did, not telling anybody anything. What did I do to recover? So that's what we're trying to do here. And we read this third step prayer last night. Basically, relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do your will. Relieve me of my selfishness that I may better help others. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. Take away my difficulties so I can be an example that this works. This is what these old-timers were doing with me. I walked into that meeting and I sat down and there was nothing funny about my life. And these guys were sitting there and they knew where I was at. And they started telling stories and laughing about the things that were killing me. There was nothing funny about my life. I'd lost my family, my business, my children. It was a disaster. And these guys are telling similar stories and they're laughing. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, how did you get from where I am to where you are? And I got to tell you, I wanted what they had in the worst way. They were demonstrating the third step prayer right in front of my face. God had removed their difficulties. And victory over their difficulties was bearing witness to me that this worked. And I walked with them, and those guys, I love the old guys, I really do. I had nothing but respect for those guys. So we left off, we found it very desirable right after the third step prayer.
Yep. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand.
Do you understand that? Let's say that you're fairly new here and you've made a decision. This all sounds reasonable. I'm going to go out and I'm going to help others. I'm going to do 12-step work. And you go back to your family and your friends and your AA group and you say, you know, I've made a decision. I'm going to do this. You know what will happen? Your family will look at you and they say, oh, for God's sakes. Now he's really gone off the deep end. You know? You got to get a job. You got to go to school. You got to make some money. And they'll talk you right out of it. It's better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. It's better to just shut up and do it. I know, because I talked to some people, and I'm telling you, well-meaning people in AA will say, oh boy, now you're going a little too far. You're not really going to turn your will and life over to God, are you? And you know why it's a problem? Because the contrast between what we're talking about doing and doing may not be where they're at. And you make them look bad, actually. Kind of reflects negatively on the guy who ain't doing much. Oh, yeah. It's better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. That's been my experience.
Yeah, but you know, you're feeling really good, and people will say, oh, you can run that pink cloud. You got to get off that pink cloud.
Yeah, it's sad.
You know? Yeah. Why? Why do I have to get off that pink cloud? I like being on that pink cloud. What do I have to get off?
I'm telling you, they've been telling me that for 24 years. You got to come off that treatment center high. I'm not coming down, guys. I don't care what they say. You don't have to come down.
Right. So the wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made an effect, sometimes a very great one was felt at once.
Yeah, the wording was quite optional. So how about this for the third step prayer? God, take away my difficulties so I can show others this crap works.
It's pretty optional.
Well, I mean, it says it, doesn't it? It puts it in, put it in terms that is acceptable to you. That's why we take the these and thous out of it. I mean, nobody talks that way. You know, when you read the prayer that way, nobody knows what the heck you're talking about, you know? I got to put it in terms that are acceptable to me. The wording is quite optional, so long as it expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation.
Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted.
You notice it doesn't say 6 months later. It says next, yeah.
Yeah, but...
Oh, no, easy does it. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but you run into people, you know. I've only been in AA for 3.5 years, and I'm getting ready to work up to my four step now. Yeah.
I haven't suffered enough.
Yeah.
I got to suffer a little more before I'm going to do it.
Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom. So we had to get down to causes and conditions.
Yeah, so I'm not going to fight the booze anymore. The booze isn't the problem. We're going to get down to causes and conditions of why I don't like reality. How come I don't like what is? I hate what is. I want it my way. I'm selfish. That's what it is. See? So though our decision, third step decision, was vital and crucial, it'll have little permanent effect. You know, you see guys doing the waltz all the time. You know, they do the 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. They will not do inventory. They come right up against it, and they go, oh, they read it off the wall. Oh, that smacks of judgment. I'm not doing that. And it does when you read it off the wall. Fearless and thorough moral inventory. I mean, holy cow. Then the treatment centers where I come from, you know what they have us do? Well, we'll write a sin list of all the terrible things you did.
You ever
I'm
do
not
that?
Kidding you. They did this in the treatment center. And you write everything you did that was bad. They'd have no idea what the inventory is. Thank God that's not the inventory. But that's what they would ask us to do. We'll write all the bad things you did, and somehow you're supposed to feel better. And then if you didn't feel bad enough, you know what they did? And I'm serious about this. They'd have family week, and they'd bring your family in just to prove what a jerk you really are. You know? I saw guys leave the treatment center over that stuff. I'm serious, you know? Just judgment. Just judgment everywhere. We're going to force this guy to change and tell him how crappy he is. That's the beauty of AA. You know, you walk into an AA meeting like I did with those old-timers, none of those guys were judging me. When a new guy comes in, we forget to judge him for a minute. And that's where the healing happens. Give us another couple weeks, then we start judging them, right? Yeah. Hammering on them. You got to do this. Oh, boy. It's terrible.
So here's what this is. This is a miracle. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade.
See, Joe and Charlie did a great service to us when they pointed this out, I think, in their big book seminars. And Bill is softening this up. I mean, the step reads made a searching and fearless moral inventory. And, of course, you look the word moral up, it smacks of judgment. It's ethical. Good, bad, right, wrong. Our religion is ethical in this country. I mean, this is the problem. We're looking at everything as good and bad sort of thing. He's softening this thing up by saying we're going to take a searching, a fact-finding, fearless, fact-facing, moral, truthful. Now, that is not what moral means in the dictionary. But that's what he's doing with it. He's softening this thing. He's taking out the judgment, in a sense, with it.
One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values.
I got to quit lying to myself about what works and doesn't work. I got to stop lying to myself. See, these are ideas, thoughts. What thoughts of mine don't work? It's the same thing with a business. You got to get rid of what isn't valuable. Well, what's valuable is what works. What isn't valuable is what doesn't work. It's the same thing. And he's going to say this in the next sentence.
Well, so what do you do if you inventory this room?
You count the chairs, don't you?
You judge the chairs?
You don't look at a chair that's broken and say, it's a bad chair, do you? It's a broken chair. Get rid of it promptly and without regret.
Doesn't work as a chair. Nothing bad about it. Just doesn't work as a chair. Get rid of it. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly.
Yeah. We did the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. It doesn't say we took stock morally or judgmentally. We took stock honestly. We're going to be honest with ourselves.
First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure.
I was interested in that.
Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender.
That is one of the most often misquoted sentences in meetings out of the big book, all over where I come from. People say, yep, resentment's the problem. No, it's not. No, it's not. Being convinced, the first 100 people wrote this, we were convinced that self, Rick's will, I want what I want, selfishness. Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us. Came about in my life experiences, manifested. We're going to consider the common manifestations of self. Resentment is the number one common manifestation of self. Self is the problem. Resentment is the outcome. If I'm selfish, I will be resentful. It's as basic as that. But if you look at, well, resentment's the problem, then guess what? You won't look at the selfishness, see? And you know what? I did some of that, and then I stayed sober. I resolved a bunch of conflicts, a bunch of anger went, and then I stayed with the selfishness and started building cases again in sobriety. You guys probably haven't done any of that sort of thing, but that happened to me. That actually happened to me. Oh, yeah. Get on a board of directors of a club, and you'll understand this really well. Clubhouses are, yeah. Then you'll see time doesn't mean much in terms of sobriety when people start fighting over property and money, and oh, it's unbelievable. So resentment is the number one common manifestation of self.
It destroys more alcoholics than anything else.
Resentment does.
From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically.
Okay, so what's a spiritual malady? Holding resentment is what spiritual illness is. Why? Because it separates me from the guy I'm angry at. Look, as soon as you get angry, you know this from relationships. As soon as you get angry, you want to get away from her, don't you? I don't want to be around her. I want to leave. You just want to go. Separation. You can feel the split happen as soon as you get angry. And, you know, if you hang on to it, you feel very isolated and alone. Chuck C. called it apart from. Okay? And that's the experience. You feel separate. Alone. And then I'll want to get somebody and tell them the story. And I'll tell Bob or somebody the story of how they wronged me or what they're doing so I can justify my anger. Because it's very hard to be sick alone. You got to share it. And the more you share it, the tighter you bind yourself to the grievances, see? Well, when the spiritual illness is overcome, malady means illness, we straighten out mentally and physically. So I can't straighten out mentally and physically first. The mental and physical ailments are emanating from holding grievances. Isn't that what they're saying? Now, that is not society. Society doesn't think this way, but it's their experience. And you can say, well, I don't agree with that, and that's fine. But it still is their experience of what they saw going on. So I got to deal with this stuff that's causing my pain. I mean, it's like taking a bomb out of your lap and slipping it under your chair. It's still going to blow up. Okay?
So in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper.
We write them down. You can't do it in your head. That's what I was doing when I got into AA. Doing everything in my head. And I stayed angry.
We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry.
Okay, that's column one on page 65. I'm resentful at people, institutions, or principles. Well, people's, that's easy to understand. Principles and institutions. You know, I'm telling you, and I don't say this to be funny, although it is absurd. When I came into AA, I had unconditional hate. I hated everybody. I'm telling you, I felt like everybody was against me, and I had a lot of anger toward institutions. Okay? Northern States Power Company, the gas company, the meter maids, the police force, the courts, Hennepin County, Ramsey County. Right down, I mean, I was just angry at everything. And I was getting even. I mean, I was constantly getting even. I went to great extent with a resentment. Just quickly, I'll tell you. They shut my gas off. I had a duplex. I lived on the second floor, and they shut my gas off on the first floor because the tenant moved out. Okay? And then a new tenant came in, and they wouldn't turn the gas back on until I paid a $60 bill. Now, my gas in my unit was shut off, too, because I'd spend my money on things, other things besides bills. Okay? You know. And, of course, I don't want to spend my money. I want to spend your money on my utility bills. So I manipulated. There's a program called Heat Share with the Salvation Army where they would help to pay your bill. So I had an $1,800 bill. I got it all paid up on my unit, and they wouldn't turn my gas on because of a $60 bill from the first floor. I said, that's crazy. That's a different account. It's got nothing to do with this. I paid, and I was right, I think, on this. Okay, it doesn't matter if you're right. Doesn't matter if you're right. You're still going to get killed when you do what I did, okay? They said, we don't get it because they're going to strong-arm me on it. Okay, you're going to strong-arm me, huh? All right. I built a wall across the basement because in Minneapolis, you know, you got basements and you got, in the duplex, there's a common entrance to the basement. I built a wall across. I put a steel door on it. I'm a plumber by trade, so I just bypassed my gas meter. Now, the first floor has got a gas meter, and that thing turns, you know, and I know by law you got to let them in every 11 months. So I let them in. I take the harness off, put the meter back in that I made. And then they read the meter. Mine hasn't moved. They go out, and I hook it back up again. I did that for 3 years over a $60 bill. You think that's a little extreme? I don't like to get even. I like to get over even. You know what I'm saying? This is the kind of craziness. I'm bypassing water meters. They'd shut my water up. I'd take a stop box key, go out there, and turn it back on. I didn't care. I just didn't care. I had huge resentments against institutions. So I know what that is. Principles. How about principles?
Principles.
You got any principles in there?
I hate it that you got to sit at a red light at 4 in the morning when there's no traffic coming. I hate that. Yeah. I mean, you know, something simple like that, I can work up a real good head of steam over that.
How about the IRS? Huh? How about them? You got principles about paying taxes. I know a guy who's livid over paying taxes. He said it was unconstitutional. I don't know if it is or not. I don't care. You know? But he was rageful. So he's taken advantage of the system. He was angry at the county. He took advantage of welfare and things like that, justifying his stealing, see, by his anger. Institution, you could be angry at the Catholic Church. The principle of having to be married before you can have sex. How about that one, you know? Because every time you go to church, you're guilty because you're doing it, you know? Isn't that great? So you just leave the church. That's the way to deal with that, right? Just go. Because I don't like the principle, see? That's being angry at a principle. I'm not taking a stand on any of this, guys. I'm really not. It's just that's an example of a principle. So that might lead you into some anger that you're unaware of. Wherever there's anger, it's going to cause you separation. And it's going to cause you pain. So that's the first column. People, institutions, or principles with whom we're angry.
We asked ourselves why we were angry.
That's column two, the cause. Why am I angry?
In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up.
That's why I'm angry. Something feels threatened. Somebody's threatening. I feel like I'm going to lose something. I'm going to lose something.
On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries.
So there's the third column, the effects my. How was I injured by what that person did or the situation?
Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations which had been interfered with?
Yeah, what was interfered with? Okay, by what they did. How was I interfered? Was my self-esteem interfered with? How I see myself, how I want others to see me? I mean, that's what self-esteem is. I want to hold a certain image in people's eyes. You know, maybe I go to the AA meeting and I want my AA buddies to think I'm a good guy, but I go home and I knock the kids around or the wife or something like that. I don't want people to know that. And then somebody exposes me for that. Self-esteem is injured, that sort of thing, you know. Security is looked at as money in here. It's listed under money. It could be emotional security, but that's not the way they've got it listed. They got it around finances in the columns. So somebody steals some money or take advantage of me or not pay me money back or whatever happened, okay? Is my ambitions. You know, ambitions was a big one for me. I had lots of ambitions. I had a goal to have a family and a couple of kids in the dream. And Pam, when I was 2.5 months sober, walked on me. And I lost everything. I couldn't get her back. And understandably, if you understood the circumstances, I wouldn't have stayed. I wouldn't have spent 3 months with her if she did what I did to her for 11 years. I wouldn't have taken it for 3 months. Wow, and then I'm angry at her, man. She spent 11 years getting tortured. No, that's her own choice. I agree. It's her own choice. But the fact of the matter is, wow, I wouldn't have put up with it. I got to keep that stuff in mind. I had an ambition to have kids and a family when she left my goal. Ambitions are goals. My goal was removed, taken away. Lost my family. So ambitions might be at the job, at the workplace, or something like that. You know, maybe we're trying to get a career or something like that going. You want to step up the ladder and somebody gossiped about you, or maybe they told the truth and you didn't want it exposed, or said you were an alcoholic and it caused you a problem at the job, or something like that, you know. Interfere in my goal, my ambition. Then you got personal or sex relations. Maybe I'll tell Bob something about Bob, the taper, and I don't want Bob to feed that back to him, and he does. Now he's interfered in my personal relationship with the other Bob. See? And I'm angry because he did that. Or in sexual relations. Maybe I lost a woman. Maybe some guy took her away from me, and I'm angry. Interfered in my, or they gossiped or said something negative, and it caused me a lot of heartache, and that sort of thing, you know? These are things that I've had to look at, but that's, I think, what we're talking about here. And I'm sure many of you could add to that list, but it's just a way of getting some sense of what we're angry at. These first three columns are simply the story of why I'm angry. It's not the solution. We're not trying to solve anything. We're just trying to get the story down so we know what our story is. That's all it is.
The story I tell myself to justify my anger. That's what these three columns are.
Right. And it does justify your anger. It's absolutely justified. I'm not going to sit here and tell you your anger is not justified. Of course it's justified, especially the way you tell the story. So I don't tell guys, you know, that their stories are wrong. I let them have an experience where God controlled this. I don't, you know, get in the middle of that stuff.
Well, you think about justifiable anger. All anger is justified, isn't it? If it wasn't justified, wouldn't I have to say I'm really angry at you, but I don't have any reason to be? You know, it's justified by the story I tell myself.
Yeah.
That's the,
of course.
But is it true?
Yeah, but is it accurate?
Accurate is the idea, yes. Yeah. Is it accurate?
I don't like to say, is it true, because there may be elements of truth in it, but is it accurate? It's really...
We were usually as definite as this example. So if you look at these examples, these are not 10-page essays. And it doesn't say we were much more definite than this example. It says we were usually as definite as this example. So get the story down in simple terms so you can see what the story is. The story, you notice, I'm sure, over the years that the stories have a way of changing as we tell them to different people in different places. The stories change.
They get more guilty.
Yeah, I've told stories and made them better. As you know, you polish it up a little bit. And then I believe my story. I am committed to my story. My story is absolutely, this is what it is.
Buy a ticket to your own show.
Yep. So we're usually as definite as this example. So I'm resentful at Mr. Brown. The cause, his attention to my wife. This affects my sex relations, my self-esteem, and fear is bracketed.
See, he's afraid of losing his wife. That's why he's angry. Fear is what motivates the anger. And it's based in him, in his selfishness. I want what I want. I want things my way.
I'm resentful at Mr. Brown. The cause? He told my wife of my mistress.
That'll cause you a problem. I mean, it will. Even if it's not true, you will have long conversations into the evening, even if it's not true. Now, you got to understand, the way it's worded here, it looks like it's true because he says, told my wife of my mistress. So apparently, he had a mistress. All right, but still, nevertheless, that'll cause you a lot of trouble. And that will interfere in your sex relations. No
probably with both of them.
You know, we laugh at this stuff, but when it's your crap, it ain't funny.
Well, this is what you were talking about when you first came in, and the old-timers are sitting around laughing at this stuff,
oh, yeah.
And you're saying, this
oh,
is killing me.
Tragic.
You know,
it was
exactly
killing me.
Sure. It affects my self-esteem. Fear is bracketed.
Fear. He's afraid of what? Being exposed for having a mistress and looking that way. Yeah, self-esteem.
I'm resentful at Mr. Brown. The cause? Brown may get my job at the office.
You got to kill Brown. That's all there is to it.
If this is true, you got to put a contract on this guy. Yeah.
You do. You got to kill him if this is true.
This affects my security,
money,
my self-esteem. Fear is bracketed. Notice how fear is bracketed.
I'm afraid of losing. Every one of these is afraid of losing something. See? Fear of loss. Fear of loss. Yeah. So that's the story of why he's angry at Mr. Brown is perfectly justified under these conditions. That's right.
I'm resentful at Mrs. Jones. The cause, she's a nut. She snubbed me. She committed her husband for drinking. He's my friend. She's a gossip.
Oh, boy.
This affects my personal relationship, my self-esteem. Fear is bracketed.
Look, you ever been around somebody who's nuts and they're gossiping about you? You know how threatening that is? I mean, even if it's not true stuff, it still causes you all kinds of heartache and trouble. Yet we do this crap around our fellowship a lot. We gossip negatively about each other, you know? It really causes problems with the harmony in our groups and that sort of thing. It's very destructive. Well, when somebody's doing this about you and they're nuts, that's even worse if somebody's nuts and they're gossiping about you. So that's a big threat to his self-esteem, isn't it? How he sees himself, how he wants others to see him. That's right. It's tough. This stuff is painful.
I'm resentful at my employer. The cause, he's unreasonable, unjust, and overbearing. Threatens to fire me for drinking and padding my expense account.
Well, I understand how you look at that, but think of it this way, okay? When they wrote this, these guys, most of these guys, a lot of them were salesmen, okay? And they're wining and dining clients, and that's perfectly fine. You take them out to dinner, you buy drinks, you do that stuff. So it's not as cut and dried as it actually looks on paper here, you know? That was a normal process for doing business and that sort of thing. So, but he's threatening to fire him for drinking and padding his expense account. That's a little overdoing it sort of thing. So I mean, it kind of looks like, well, you could kind of resolve this, you know, even looking at that, but not necessarily.
And any of you guys, I know a lot of you guys are in business, you know that you do the paperwork in the office, but you made the deal in the bar or the restaurant. That's where the deal goes down. So you're on an expense account? Sure. Of course you are.
So that affects my what if he fires me?
Self-esteem? Security?
Yeah. Money. I lose my job. I look like a failure. You know, men are very tied to what they do. They really are. And when they lose a job, it's almost like pulling off your legs or something. You know, it's very. It affects men different than it does women in that sense. Our identities are wrapped up in our images of ourselves. Our ego self is all wrapped up in what we do.
I'm resentful at my wife. The cause, she misunderstands and nags. Likes Brown.
Here he comes again, huh?
Wants house put in her name.
Oh, sure. Lose the house and she takes Brown, you know. Brown is going to make the house payment.
Yeah. This affects my pride, personal and sex relations, security, and fear is bracketed.
See, he's afraid. Afraid of losing his house, afraid of losing his wife. You know, I sponsor Mr. Brown. You know that? I actually sponsor a guy who did all these things that Brown did in here. Supposedly did, yeah.
Yeah, he's in our meeting. His nickname is Mr. Brown. That's how he's known in the group, is Mr. Brown.
Yeah. Yeah. Did all this stuff.
Now, under my employer, it you begin to get a little bit of a sensor. You look at that and you say, well, okay, sure, I can see where the... And the problem with that is people look at this and they think there's resolution in these first three columns. This is just the story. There's no solution in here. This is just simply the story of why I'm angry. That's what these first three columns are. So we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong.
No question about it. When you look at those first three columns, when you've written them down in that way, the world and its people are quite wrong. No question in my mind.
To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got.
It's as far as I ever got. You're wrong. You caused me all these problems. My life would have been fine if you hadn't come along and did this to me.
The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness.
Well, if you don't see that after writing those first three columns, it leads to futility and unhappiness for me.
To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile?
You see that? Because you're in the past. All anger is about something that's already gone. And I'm dragging the past around. Well, the past is gone. So I'm in a gone place whenever I'm thinking about the past. And then when I'm anticipating the future's not here. How much time do I spend gone? Well, you'll squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. That's all. The only time you can really be alive is right now. This is the only time there is. Yet I'm in the past, and I'm in the future, and I'm dragging the past experiences, projecting them onto the future, trying to control future happenings by past experiences. My God. I'm not alive. I'm just dead. I'm in a gone place.
But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave.
Boy, it's infinitely grave.
We found that it is fatal.
They mean dead, dead. They're not speaking figuratively, you know.
For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again, and with us to drink is to die.
When harboring angry, resentful feelings, I shut myself off from the only solution to my alcoholism. Yep. And we drink again. The insanity of alcohol returns. I shut myself off from God. I'll show you. I'll kill me. Isn't that brilliant? It's absolutely brilliant.
If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison.
Yep. I'll show you. I'll kill myself because I'm angry at you. Hey, Dad, I see what a jerk you've been to me all my life. I'm going to hold negative thoughts in my mind and hurt myself. It's so insane, yet we do it. I get angry over some stupid, trivial thing during the course of the day, and I cause pain to my own mind, and I blame the other guy. I blame somebody else. It's not the events that have been the problem. It's how I think about the events. The event was over 30 years ago in some cases. Who's hurting me with it now? I'm dragging this crap along and I'm causing pain to my own mind by how I think about it. Wow. And then I'm blaming other people for doing it.
We turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future.
So we're going
to
look at these stories again.
We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle.
Yeah, what's the angle we've been looking at it from? What they did to us, right? So I'm prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. And I'll tell you what most guys do then. They say, oh, well, we'll look for our part then. That's not what they're saying. We're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. They're not telling you what that is, but we make assumptions. Whenever I did this, I know. Make an assumption how what it's supposed to look like. That's not what they're saying. They're saying we're just prepared, we're willing to look at it from a different angle instead of what we've been looking at it from.
We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us.
You bet.
In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill.
Yeah, it doesn't even matter if it's fancied or real. It's still destroying me.
How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol.
Yeah, so I know I'm angry. I still got the grievances. I've got stories to justify it. And I can't get out of it. I keep justifying my anger through these stories. What a place to find yourself. It doesn't matter if you've been sober a long time. You can be picking this stuff up with a lot of sobriety and doing it. You know, sometimes a guy will act like, well, just because I'm 35 years sober or something, I don't have any of these experiences. Oh, really? Yeah.
This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick.
What, does that sound like a bunch of crap or what? Oh, perhaps they're spiritually sick. Hey, if you've been molested or raped or beaten or whatever, that sounds kind of offensive, doesn't it, at first, you know? Oh, perhaps they were spiritually sick. Hey, I wanted to kill people. I was violent inside. I don't know about you guys, but I mean that. I was really violent inside. I'm the angriest guy in the world. Really. And when I read that, I almost quit reading the big book. I just about said, this is a bunch of crap. Now we're going to justify some crappy behavior from somebody else. That's how I felt when I first read that. I almost stopped right there. Thank God I kept going because it's nothing like that. It's absolutely nothing like that. Look at where this goes. So we realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. So that's sort of an attitude change, isn't it?
Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too.
Wow. Self-forgiveness. Can you hear that? That's what he's saying. This is self-forgiveness. Why? Think about it. Do I want compassion and understanding for my mistakes? I've done a lot of dumb things out of my addictions. Did I want Pam to come back? Yeah. I wanted my family to come back. I wanted her to give me a chance again. Give me a break. Do I want people to give me a break when I cheated in relationships and maybe split up my family, did something stupid like that because I couldn't control myself out of my addiction for sex? Or because I stole from grandma or somebody when she was dying of cancer and I wanted her drugs or something, you know? Or I took money out of her purse. Do I want these people to give me a break? Yeah, I do. Well, guess what? You're going to have to give that to others then. You know why? Because you're judging yourself as harshly as you judge other people. And if other people can't make mistakes, what am I saying to myself for the mistakes I've made? If I want people punished for the dumb things they've done out of their addictions, what am I saying to myself? I think there was a guy a few years ago who said, "Judge not lest you be judged." Well, it isn't God who's going to judge me. I'm judging myself through others. In fact, I'm using them to hurt myself. I'll give you a prime example of this. From my experience, my life. What do you got? 15 minutes?
Yeah.
Here's something that happened to me. This is classic, and I'll bet you guys have done this too. I came into AA and I changed my behavior. Okay, I was a thief, so I stopped stealing, but I stayed judgmental about stealing. Stealing's bad, right? But I've changed my behavior, so I feel better. I brought my behavior into accord with my judgmentalness. Following me on this? Okay. The problem with that is you will feel better initially, but you can't forgive yourself because you can't change that you used to steal, see? So you still got the judgment toward yourself. Invariably, this will happen. You mark my words. You guys who are sponsored, guys know it. Guy comes in and says, "Will you sponsor me?" Now, I'm about a year sober, and I'm doing this, okay? I've done some inventory, and I'm working away, and things are good, okay? He says, "Will you sponsor me?" And I said, "Sure, I've made a commitment to AA, and I'm willing to help this guy. He's a thief." I find out he's a thief. He's stealing. He's 3 years sober. I'm only a year sober, and I changed, you know? You see the problem with that idea? Oh, yeah. He should be different because he's sober longer, right? Oh, man, this will cause you all kinds of problems, you know? So now I've changed my behavior. He's a thief and he's stealing sober, and I want to kill him every time I'm around him. I don't want to help him. I want to throttle him. I want to strangle this guy. I'm violent inside myself. And then the game starts. I set out to get him to change so I'll feel better. Any of you done that? Oh, yeah. We call that sponsorship. You know what it is? You're seeing your crap in the other guy and you want to change it out there. And you know what the problem is? Even if you get that guy to change, you know what? You'll never see that the error is in you, and it'll manifest again and again and again until I deal with it within myself. That's a fact. And this guy was bringing my crap up, and I had made a commitment to AA, and I was caught because I couldn't just walk away from it. I had to deal with this. And you know what I realized? Whenever I got judgmental with him, I felt guilty. The more judgment I had for him, the more guilt. All it was doing was reinforcing my own guilt from when I was a thief. If I could come with compassion and understanding for his inability to change, it started to soften. And as time went on, I actually had a healing through seeing him differently. Do you know this is exactly what the inventory is? This is exactly what happens through the inventory process. And here's what Bill is saying. Yeah, we don't like the symptoms of their spiritual sickness and the way it disturbs us, but they, like ourselves, were sick too. So if I can get a better picture of them, I can start to see myself differently. But if I'm going to be judgmental of them, then what am I saying to myself? Then you say, well, I didn't do the same things. Yeah, the form might be different, but the content's the same. All judgment is self-judgment. All forgiveness is self-forgiveness. You're not forgiving somebody else. You know, I hear guys, I don't know if they do this around here, but I hear guys in Minneapolis say, oh, yeah, I got to put myself on top of the 8-step list. Look, all you're doing is making amends to yourself by making amends to others. It's absurd. All of this stuff is for me. You hear this crap, it's just crap, and it gets puked up from meeting to meeting to meeting. Pretty soon you got a fellowship full of nonsense. I don't know if it's happened here. You guys are probably different, but but that's the way it is where I come from, you know. Well, I got to tell you, when somebody irritates you, it's an opportunity for healing because the error is in me. You know how Bill says it in the 12 and 12? 10-step. It's a spiritual axiom. Word axiom means truth. It's a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what seems to be the cause, there's something wrong with us. That's what he's saying. It's the same thing here. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. So how do you get out of it? I keep justifying my anger through these stories. Look at this.
And I like to make fun of some of the little sayings that have caught on around the program because many of them are kind of dumb. But there is one that is true, and you'll hear this. If you spot it, you got it.
You see something, if it pisses you off, you still got it.
Yep. I see something in somebody else that I don't like. Look inside because I got it.
Now, I see things in other people, okay, that I've resolved and it doesn't offend me. If it offends you, you still got it. That's how you can tell. You got the judgment still. You've changed the behavior, but not let the judgment go. Oh, yeah. How do you like this inventory so far?
So, we don't like their symptoms. They, like ourselves, are sick too. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend.
You notice it doesn't say we asked another person? No. Another person will join you in your crap. As well-meaning as other people are sometimes, whether it be sponsors or something else, this is not about that. This is we ask God to help us, not people. So you don't get in the middle of a guy's fourth column and start telling him, well, maybe you should look at this or maybe that's all crap. This is between me and that power greater than myself. You go into the privacy of your own mind. And I got to tell you, I used to get in the middle of that crap with people all the time. And I would bind people tighter to their grievances, and I wasn't trying to do that. I don't know how to forgive anything.
I'm not sitting up here trying to tell you I know how to do it. You know, all we're ever teaching, Bob and I, or we're teaching the mechanics for God to help the guy, not me. I don't have... Guys will ask questions. Well, how do you forgive this? You know, how do you forgive... all kinds of crazy... And they give you the worst thing they could possibly think of so they can justify lesser things to hang on to, you know? That's exactly what they do, you know? I don't know. I don't have answers. I've just got shown mechanics. That's all.
If I knew how to fix anything, I would just take care of it all and we could all go home.
Bob and I'd be very wealthy if we knew how to do that.
Yeah, I'd start my own fellowship, huh? Sure. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him?"
Not how can I punish him and get even. Maybe being helpful is quit hurting him. Just stop hurting him would be helpful, wouldn't it?
God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done.
Those are prayers. God, help me. Now, I didn't believe in God. I just hated how I felt. So I went into this fourth column with an attitude of, I hate how I feel. I need to see this differently. That's the way I went in. That's the best I could do at the time.
We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way.
Why not?
If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful.
There's a third step decision again, isn't it?
We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one.
At least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view? He doesn't say it. At least my sponsor will show me how to take a kindly and tolerant view. I got nothing against sponsorship, guys. But I'm telling you, this isn't about human beings fixing each other. This is about God fixing me. I don't know how to do that. And to think I do is just absolute arrogance on my part. And I used to be doing that all the time with guys when I first got sober and I had some experience of things. And I try and make the guy have the experience I had. Well, I don't know what experience he's got to have. It's personal to him. I don't know how to affect that sort of an experience. I don't have that capability. God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. That's why this is spiritual and not psychological. It's exactly why this is spiritual and not psychological.
Referring to our list again.
Here's the fourth column.
Putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes.
Uh-oh. We're going to look for our own mistakes. It doesn't say we're looking for our part.
And you hear
it's
that
all over. Looking for our part. No, we're not. It's all over our fellowship in Minneapolis. Oh, yeah. Well, if you're looking for your part, you haven't put out of your mind the wrongs others have done, have you? And you're going to keep justifying what I did by what they did. You have to put out of your mind the wrongs others had done and look for where I made mistakes. We made up some sheets, and we'll hand them out at the next session. And we put the first three columns on the front like that. We put the fourth column on the back. And the reason we did that, we just broke it into questions. The reason we did it that way is the first three are on the front. That's the wrongs they did, right? For one person, one guy. Put out of your mind the wrongs others have done. You turn the sheet over. Now you don't have it facing you, see? You got it? I mean, this is important. It's an actual experience of putting out of your mind what they did. It's a physical experience of it. Then it says, our own mistakes. Put out of my mind the wrongs others had done and look for where I made mistakes. In the whole relationship, not the thing you're angry at, not the thing you're angry at, but you still have to put that out of your mind, what they did. What did I do? Where did I make mistakes? And then the questions are where the mistakes are.
Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault...
Okay, we'll give you that much.
We tried to disregard the other person involved entirely.
He says it again. Disregard them entirely, regardless of whether you had or they had some interaction with it.
Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white.
We write it down.
We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight.
Wow. Okay.
We're going to be out of time here. We'll have to pick this up during the next day. We'll go over this again. This altered me. I didn't see that I was bad. You know what I saw through inventory? I was wrong. What's the matter with being wrong? It's devastating when you've been slamming somebody for 20 years based on a story that's not even accurate. That's a little rough to look at. Yet I'll give you concrete examples from my own life as we go through this. I'll tell you the stories of how things unfolded for me. Maybe it'll help, maybe it won't. It's just my experience. It may not help at all, but at least it'll give you some sense if you don't understand it. Sounds like a lot of you guys do understand this process. But if you're new, maybe it'll help to see. It's not about pardoning people for the terrible things they did. That just means you're right. It's about seeing it differently. Years ago, I watched a video of a guy, and I can't prove this, guys. I'm just reporting what he said. He said he read the Aramaic Bible. He wanted to read the language that Jesus spoke in. He said, is this what he said? He says, in Aramaic, the word forgive meant to change your mind. He said when they translated to Greek, it came out to pardon because they didn't have a word for that. I don't know if this is true or not. I'm just telling you what he said. To pardon somebody for what they did and to change your mind is two different things. If you pardon somebody, that just means you're right and your anger is justified. That's not what happened to me through this. This process is a change of mind, is a transformation of mind. And if you're not having that, you're missing it. That's all.
And there's no healing in that. See, I was right. I'm a good guy. I'm bigger than you. I can forgive you because I'm better than you.
Forgive you for being a jerk.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. It just means you're right and you bind yourself tighter to it, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, we'll pick this up. I know we're out of time. Bob's got a CD to shut down here. So we'll see you next session.
Good. Thanks for next time.